Thank you, Your Honor. Steve Perfermit, representing the petitioners, registration number 27442. May it please this court. Petitioners here are all off-airport parking operators. What they do is they operate parking services, parking lots, near Denver International Airport, but not on airport property. The only use of the airport property that they make is driving on the airport roadways to and from Level 5. Level 5 of the parking, not the parking structure, but actually at the terminal, is where they pick up and drop off passengers and then take them back to their cars. Now, in late 2000...
Do they come on call, or do they just constantly rotate like the rental cars do?
It's a constant rotation. They come in, they sweep through to see if there are passengers to be picked up or if they have passengers to drop off, and then they make their stops and then go back. So they don't do it on call, but do it on a regular basis.
And just curiously, taking one of your plaintiffs, how many buses do they have doing this all day long?
Oh, wow. I know one of the plaintiffs, for example, I think it's the parking spot runs 20 or 30 buses.
All day long, constantly rotating?
No, Your Honor. It varies by the time of the day. Late, you know, 2 in the morning when this terrible accident occurred, they wouldn't have had many of these buses out there because there just aren't that many passengers. They would run during peak hours, different season, okay, depending on how many cars they have in the lot, things
like that.
But
they don't run on call?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that's actually important here because what we're talking about is the usage of the airport. In our appeal is based on Denver Revised Municipal Code, Section 5-16E. And in 2010, the airport implemented this new gross revenues procedure where they charge 8% of the gross revenues of my clients for permission to access the airport and pick up and drop off passengers.
As opposed to the access fee per trip?
It had multiple components. There were three components. One is a per trip access fee. The second was dwell time, which is for the time you're on the airport property, about 15 minutes, there's an additional charge.
Did that go away with the new charge?
Yes and no. For everybody else, it didn't go away. It stayed as is.
Right. No, I mean for your clients.
For my clients, it went away in part. The trip fee went away. The dwell time fee increased by 10% in addition to this other increase. That was an across-the-board increase of 10% on dwell time fees for all commercial operators.
Wait. So even though your clients are now paying a percentage of their gross, they were still also paying dwell time?
That is correct.
Even after the ordinance was changed?
That is correct.
So the airport was still maintaining, still had to maintain some records of your clients on and off the premises, at least their dwell times, a funny word, but the time on the premises.
The time on the premises, it is logged by the AVI system.
Right.
Automatic vehicle identification, I believe
yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
So it triggers when they enter the premises. They still have to track that. They still pay the dwell time. So presumably they don't hang around the airport too often or too long.
Mr. Perfermit, would you tell me about limos, hotel shuttles, and taxis?
There's a slight difference between some of those. Limos and taxis are together. Hotel shuttles are a little bit separate. So I'll address them in those two groups.
Okay.
Limos and taxis pick up and drop off. I believe it's level 6. At the airport, not level 5, could be level 4. I get a little confused there every once in a while. Taxis are charged a token. They're charged according to their a certain rate. It's essentially a per access to the airport rate.
They're still using the airport, just a different level.
Exactly. They use the roadways, but then a different level.
Okay.
The limos also drop off and pick up at that different level. I believe they're subject to the standard trip and dwell time fee that hotel shuttles are also paying. Hotel shuttles, I think, are the most interesting one here because they're the most analogous to my clients and yet are treated very differently. They continue to be on the old regime in which, so you go from the Holiday Inn that's near the airport and the shuttle accesses the airport using the AVI access and it records a trip fee. And then when it is on the airport, it records how long it's there, they pay a dwell time fee.
And I'm assuming that the evidence showed that the hotel shuttles have a regular trip to the airport.
The evidence, Your Honor, showed not only that they have a regular trip to the airport, but that they simultaneously access the airport significantly more than my clients.
Who
and
does?
Pay Hotel shuttles.
All of them collectively?
Collectively, yes.
There might be 50 hotels that use the airport.
Collectively, and I'm reviewing this collectively on all of this evidence. I can talk a little bit about specifics of my clients as well. But the records that we have from the airport are maintained on a collective basis. The hotel shuttles access the airport more than my clients. My clients pay significantly more than hotel shuttles. And that is really the basis of our appeal.
Collectively.
Yeah, how do we know they pay collectively more? I mean, maybe individually, perhaps, they have a different fee structure, but how do we know that results in more revenue to the city?
Well, what we have is...
Does the record show that?
The best record evidence we have with respect to the revenue for the city relates to Colorado Airport parking. It's one of my clients that has the longest tenure. One of the problems is...
So we don't have evidence of the total hotel revenue. Is that what you're saying?
We do have evidence of total hotel revenue. I believe it's expressed in Exhibit P20 below. We also have an Exhibit P19 below, trip and dwell time data, showing that there are more trips made by hotel shuttles in the collective than airport parking. And yet,
in a 24-hour period or what? In a month?
In
what
a year.
Period? In a year.
I think we also have it by month. I don't believe we have it by week or day.
So they pay, they make, the hotels collectively make more trips than one of your clients?
Than my clients, and they pay less.
What is that? I'm not sure what that tells us. I mean, they make more trips because there's 20 hotels and you have one client. It means they take more people collectively.
It means they use the airport more, and yet they pay less. And Section 5-16E requires the fees to be apportioned among the users of the airport based on their actual projected use of the airport.
Well, it says based on reasonable distribution, reasonable apportionment. Is that, in your view, that means equal?
I don't know if it can be equal.
So it doesn't mean equal then?
But it doesn't necessarily mean absolute equal, but what it does mean is that you cannot have a regime in which, and using the actual numbers from Colorado Airport parking, which we presented through expert testimony, which is the parking, off-airport parking service provider that has the longest tenure at the airport. What it doesn't mean is that without any increase in usage, that their fees can go from $250 on average access to $10 on average trip. From $15,000.
Now, where do you get that prohibition from the language that the fees can't go up? Because it just says you have to reasonably apportion it. What if everyone's fees went up? Then you would have no case?
If everyone's fees went up an apportionate amount, I would have no case.
Right, so the fact that it went up is irrelevant. It's a question of, in your view, of equity among the users?
It's a question of reasonable apportionment. And I think there's both a substantive and a procedural aspect. Procedurally, they did nothing. The evidence is clear. The airport did nothing to attempt to determine how the access, the use of the airport, of the off-airport parking service providers compared to other users. Second, as a substantive component, in which we know that based on no increase in usage, according to undisputed, unrebutted expert testimony, no increase in usage, but a 3 or 4 time increase in the fees on one category of airport user. The other categories of airport users also using the airport roadways, also using level 5, such as hotel shuttles, did not see their rates increase.
And I take it that you're saying that's because they don't have this revenue fee structure applied to the hotel shuttles?
That is correct. They do not.
So how would that work as a practical matter to apply that fee structure? I mean, it's based on the gross revenues derived from operations at or near the airport. Well, that doesn't apply to most of any hotels. They're not operating at the airport, or most of them are not anywhere near the airport. So how could they possibly apply this structure to hotels?
Well, the ones that are operating at or near the airport are the ones running shuttles to the airport on a regular basis.
And what do you mean
basis?
By near? I mean, I don't see any hotels near the airport when I go there.
There are the new ones just off Pena Boulevard and I-70. That is near the airport.
On I-70? That's your view of near the airport?
On Pena Boulevard at I-70.
And those ones are running shuttles. And on Tower Row, there are numerous airports that run shuttles back and forth. Well, you're close.
And there's lots of ones downtown. I guess the question is what any of them are near the airport.
I'm not aware of any of them that operate shuttles on a regular basis to and from the airport. There's also a category under the Rule 100 that has a separate structure for infrequent users. So if somebody, say, at the Brown Palace were to take the car out to the airport, that would be under a totally different structure because it's a different situation. But what we're talking about...
So if we had a hotel that... Sorry to interrupt you, but if we had a hotel that was near the airport, you would say they would have like 8% of the hotel revenues under this theory, and you think that's be a practical application to the hotel shuttles?
No, Your Honor, because it's a reasonable apportionment of the expenses of the airport to the users according to their use. So what you do is you look at, maybe the airport hotels are generating a lot more revenue. My clients are generating $20 a day, they're generating $100 a day. Well, maybe their percentage is 1%. But you do it in a manner that is intended to reasonably apportion it among the users based on their use. Now, frankly...
So you're not asking for this exact rule to apply to everyone. You agree the airport can have different fee structures for different users. And that would be reasonable.
If it's
and isn't that what we have here?
If there's a reasonable apportionment of the expenses based upon use. Now, let's compare what's being done now to what was done before. What was done before, according to expert testimony, resulted in, on a per-trip basis, there being a band. It's not perfect, but each of the users, limo services, taxi services, hotel shuttles, you know, things like that, all paying, I think it was between like $250 and $375 per trip. It's not perfect, but it's the difference is relatively negligible. Here, the difference is $250 to $10. And only off-airport parking being required to shoulder this additional burden.
So now what I hear you saying is it's the amount your clients are paying and not the mechanism. For example, if they had gone to 2% of your gross revenues, and then your rate would have been $250 instead of $10, perhaps, you wouldn't be complaining.
Well, we certainly think that the prior regime made a whole lot more sense because it is directly related to use. But could there be a proxy that would work? If they did the proper study, if they looked and said, how much are you using it, what is the impact on the airport, and therefore we're going to try and approximate it. For there's some arguments that have been made about the AVI system is difficult to use, the trip fee is difficult, of course it's being used for everybody else, dwell time is still being used for us as well, but let's accept that argument at face value.
Is it being used for the rental car shuttles?
The rental car shuttles are, I believe that they are paying a dwell time, I'm not sure on that.
So it may not be used for everybody else.
Well, they're on airport, so they're a slightly different situation because they're paying their fees and charges, and their percentage of revenues is also rent. And
okay,
so they're a completely
you.
Separate situation.
Well, Mr. Perferment, isn't that essentially what has been done here, is they've treated it like a net lease? And although you're not on airport property, you're paying a percentage of your income.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. And the difference is, because the ordinance says it has to be based on use of the property, it makes sense if you are actually occupying the space, if you have a concession, if you're on property owned by the airport, that may make sense. But to impose a similar burden and a disproportionate burden to others who do not work on airport property, and where the hearing officer found that my clients only use the roadways in level 5, they're not occupying real estate, it's unfair to treat them as if they essentially were. And again, further to your point, Your Honor, if there were a way to do this in which the apportioned expenses ended up being relatively even, that could be okay. But
again, it's about equity in your view. It's not about the particular method. The result has to be equitable to you.
The result has to be a reasonable apportionment. And here we have a grossly inequitable apportionment that does not fit within any definition of the term reasonable. For no increase in use whatsoever.
But isn't it generally reasonable to measure use by the gross revenues earned at or near the airport? Isn't that a measure of use?
Gross revenues could be a measure of benefit. But you have to show what
How is it a measure of use? I mean, the more you use the airport, the more revenues you're going to have.
Not necessarily. One of the problems with that formulation, for example, is my clients offer valet parking for additional fee. One customer using valet parking, one customer self-parking, will pay different rates to my clients. They'll be charged an additional fee by the airport because of the 8% structure. There is no additional use whatsoever of the airport.
Right, so it's not a perfect structure, but you've said before, perfection is not required.
Perfection is not required, but what we have here is a gross misallocation. And that is, I think, where you have gotten to the point where it is not appropriate. So if they had done the appropriate studies, if they had determined what the use is, if they had attempted to come up with a number that approximates that use and treats my clients equally as similarly situated other users of the airport as required by the ordinance, that'd be fine. They didn't do it here.
Thank you.
Are you still arguing about, and this is hard to ask, about the costs that are included in the ground transportation cost center?
Yes, because I think that that is, I see my time's expired, if I could answer.
Please.
The reason we've included that is because the airport's justification for what they did is that they needed to rectify a loss, not a profit, but a loss in the ground transportation
right.
cost center.
Don't you think they have the right to do that?
They do, but two things they don't have the right to do. One is to allocate all of the expenses to that cost center to generate a loss to then collect it from the people within it. Here we showed through the evidence, and we referenced this in our brief, that, for example, $3.5 million in expenses were allocated to ground transportation for airport personnel. $0.00 were allocated in that same for that same charge to rental car services. And the person who did that allocation couldn't explain it at the hearing. So they can't misallocate expenses in order to generate a reason for seeking additional fees.
But Rule 100.22 didn't impact the allocation of expenses to the cost center.
It didn't, but the allocation of expenses is the justification for their reasonableness.
No, but 100.22 is what you're challenging, and 100.22 did not change the cost accounting.
It did not, and we're not saying that the cost accounting has to be changed. We're saying that it is unreasonable because the cost accounting is bad.
Okay.
The second thing we're saying is that once you generate a loss, you cannot recover the entirety of that loss from the shoulders of one subcategory within that cost center, which is what they've done here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Deborah Overn, attorney number 21749. I'm an assistant city attorney representing the city and county of Denver. I do have a hearing disability, so if you have questions, if I could ask that you use your microphone, I'll be fine.
Ms. Overn, isn't the subject that we were talking, that council was talking about with my colleague just before he sat down, isn't that exactly what happened here, is that the airport cook the books on expenses in order to apportion the recovery of use?
I would not say that, Your Honor.
Well, certainly no one did any kind of cost analysis or use analysis here. You went to other airports and found out what they did. Isn't that what happened?
With respect, Your Honor, no, that's not what happened. Dorothy Harris, Al Wazleski, and Amy Weston all testified about how they account for costs, where the costs come from, how those are allocated to different cost centers, and then Dorothy Harris talked about how those were allocated among the different ground transportation users. So yes, there is extensive evidence in the record. While we're on that point, Your Honor, I would like to remind the court that the basis for the lower court's decision in both the district court and at the hearing officer level was that the plaintiffs did not meet their burden of proof on evidence. They presented no evidence on costs, no evidence on allocation, whether it was reasonable or unreasonable. They presented nothing. The only thing they basically proved in their case in chief was that for two of their three plaintiffs, their rates went up. And that was about it. They didn't present evidence on any of the other issues. We moved for a Rule 50 motion at the end of the plaintiff's case in chief. And the hearing officer denied it, but he really thought very carefully about it. And he even said on the record that he thought the plaintiffs hadn't shown more than that their rates had gone up. They never presented evidence either that the previous system allocated costs properly either. As Mr. Perfernet mentioned, ground transportation was operating at a significant loss. That means their business model was being subsidized by other airport users. So when Dorothy Harris did go to other airports, it was after they had looked at the numbers, looked at the cost, tried to reduce the costs, looked at income, tried to figure out how they could adjust income in order to meet the losses that ground transportation was suffering.
Hang on one second. You said they've only put on evidence of their increase of costs. The hearing examiner denied your Rule 50 motion, so then you went forward with all of your witnesses, correct?
We had to go forward and call witnesses because our motion was denied.
And they cross-examined the witnesses and brought out all these other, all this other information that's now in front of us.
Yes, Your Honor.
So we have to decide on the record as a whole, don't we, whether the whether a reasonable apportionment was shown here or not?
I didn't catch the whole question.
Do we not have to look at the record as a whole to determine whether a reasonable apportionment was made here?
You do, Your Honor, but there is evidence in the record supporting the hearing officer's decision and supporting the district court decision, which is the Rule 106 standard of review. And the plaintiffs did not present any other evidence counter to that except for what they were able to bring out on cross-examination, which is the usual cross-examination. You make people look silly on the stand.
So was there evidence to support the following finding from the hearing officer? Number 12, no analysis was done by the manager of aviation to compare or contrast the dwell time and trip fees between off-airport parking operators and other providers who use the airport, nor whether the change in fees was relative to the past or present use. Was there evidence supporting that finding of the hearing officer?
If you look at the next paragraph, I believe that paragraph 12 of the hearing officer's ruling, the next paragraph talks about the cost center allocation. We did do an analysis. It was a different kind of analysis. It was looking at total global costs and total global income and trying to figure out how to get those to match so that the Ground Transportation Center was meeting its costs. If I remember the numbers correctly, Ground Transportation was bringing in only about 1.7% of the revenue and costing 3.7% of the costs of the airport. And so that amount had to be made up. So no, we didn't do the analysis that they would have preferred we did. But that doesn't mean we didn't do an analysis. We did do an analysis. We looked at total costs, looked at total income, and then looked at methodology to try to make the match, including what other airports were using.
Well, that's, that gets us back to the first question I asked you, Ms. Ober. When you talk about looking at the following the paragraph following the finding about no analysis being done, a disproportionate amount of expenses was allocated to the cost center.
That I don't believe that was any of the findings of fact that the hearing
ground
officer,
transportation cost center.
I don't believe that was one of the findings of fact made by the hearing officer.
But isn't that part of the evidence that was adduced through cross-examination?
I do not believe the evidence says that. Amy Weston and Al Wasileski went through the costs very carefully and produced pages and pages and pages of accounting showing where the costs came from and how they were allocated. So I can't say that there was no analysis done, Your Honor. There were extensive pages of accounting showing where the costs came from, showing the income produced by the different users, and that led to the analysis of the loss and how to recover it.
Well, it seems like the main point of difference is whether expenses regarding operating level 4 and level 6, which the plaintiffs do not use, whether any of those costs were put in the ground transportation cost center and then in turn apportioned to the plaintiffs and others who use only level 5. Judge Hyatt found that that was not the case, that
right.
4 and 6 were not included. Do you agree that the record before the ALJ was ambiguous on that point, or is Judge Hyatt reversing what the ALJ said, which I found the hearing examiner, which I found somewhat unclear?
A.B. Weston testified that the costs for levels 4 and 6 were allocated to the terminal cost center, which is paid for by the airlines, not by transportation.
Okay. So any argument they make about 4 and 6 would contradict what Amy Weston said, and Judge Hyatt's finding would be supported by Amy Weston's testimony.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. And she did not contradict that testimony on cross. I'd also like to speak about the other users and how they're allocated. First, car rental companies do pay 10% of their income, of their gross revenue, to the airport. The car rental companies on airport also pay rent. So the idea that somehow on-airport companies are paying less than off-airport is incorrect.
So just to make sure I clarify, off-airport car rental shuttles pay this 10% gross revenue?
They would. Right now, we do not have one. There was one in the past. It paid a percentage of gross revenue for access to the airport.
So that category of off-airport users pays the same or similar structure?
If they exist, okay. They would pay the same. In the past, they did. We also have a new, it's not in the record, but we're in negotiations with a new off-airport rental car company, and they'd be paying the same percentage of gross revenue fee. So they are being treated the same as a very similar business model. The car rental companies and the plaintiffs testified 99% of their customers are airport customers. And this is one of the things that makes them fundamentally different from the hotel operations that you also asked about. But first I wanted to be clear that similar users are being treated similarly.
Do the on-airport rental companies, they also pay a percentage, right?
They pay percentage of gross revenue and ground rent and a few other fees that the plaintiffs do not pay.
Okay, so it's not really a net lease. It's really a lease for the ground that they pay, and then they pay a percentage that goes to the use of level 5.
I didn't catch the end of that.
Then they pay a percentage for the use of the airport ramps.
Well, we don't differentiate it that way, but that would be one way of explaining it. They do pay ground rent. They pay a percentage of gross revenue, sometimes higher than what the plaintiffs are paying. I believe Wally Park, which is an on-airport operator, pays 18% of its gross revenue, and it also provides many of the same kinds of services that Mr. Perfumit was talking about, the valet and car washing and things like that. They are being treated very similarly to similar users.
Taking your fundamental premise, the airport's fundamental premise, that our revenues from ground transportation are not meeting our costs, the percentage you talked, why couldn't that be addressed by simply raising the access fee or this, I forget what it's called, delay time or
dwell time.
Dwell time. Why couldn't they just raise that for everybody to recapture the $3 million that you need to recapture?
That might be one method of doing it, but it isn't a required method. And the ordinance wouldn't require the airport to do that simply because that's the way it had always been done. But the other answer to your question is that Dorothy Harris testified about the accounting and administrative difficulties posed by the old method, and because we were trying to reduce costs as well as increase income, the city's major cost is labor. And so in order to reduce time and therefore staff and therefore costs, we had to find a simpler method for accounting.
But you're still charging hotels, Mountain Express, based on access. So you're still tracking the records for those shuttles, right?
But it's a smaller set of users, so it's not 100% of the users. By the car rentals and off-site providers paying a percentage of gross revenue, it's easier to account for that. It's easier to review it.
I don't understand that, because Mr. Preferment tells us there's only two or three off-site parking operators, and there's dozens and dozens of hotels that send shuttles out there. So it sounds like there's more users in the hotel category than there are off-site parking users.
The problem is that we could only charge a percentage of gross revenue on airport on the use made by airport passengers in order to make the link between their use of the airport and
I understand that.
And so to try to do the accounting that would be necessary, what percentage of the hotel users are...
I understand that. I'm talking about looking at the buses when they come on level 5, looking at the buses when they go off level 5, counting the dwell time. That accounting, it seems to me, would be equally burdensome for hotel shuttles as it would have been for the off-site parking operators. And I don't see where the administrative savings is coming, particularly since you now told us that dwell time is still being counted against the off-site parking operators.
The administrative savings comes from not having to do the same level of detailed accounting for all the users. That's where Dorothy Harris testified that this method does save her, save ground transportation money, was that it took a lot less time to review the car rental companies and the parking lot providers.
Okay, I guess I'll read her testimony, but
you can't let the perfect get in the way of the good.
No, I understand.
And again, I would say that the ordinance simply requires a reasonable allocation, and since there is evidence in the record supporting that there was an analysis of the cost of ground transportation, there was an analysis of income, there was an analysis of what other airports were doing, what is industry standard for trying to recover these costs, how are other users charged and putting all these things together to come up with a reasonable allocation of how each user should pay into the airport in order for the airport to meet its costs.
Council.
The ordinance does not require perfection. It does not require pure equality. It requires reasonableness in accordance with their use. And the use can be measured by how many, what percentage of your passengers are coming from the airport. What facilities are you using? All those things go together. What the plaintiffs want you to do is pick out a few strands here and there and make it look unreasonable. You have to look at the record as a whole and what evidence was presented and whether what we did made sense under the circumstances.
Council, do you think that the phrase reasonable apportionment or reasonably apportioned in the ordinance requires the city or the airport to treat similarly situated users similarly?
Well, that's not just reasonable apportionment, but it's also, as a public entity, we have to comply with due process and equal protection and those sorts of things.
I understand there's constitutional issues, but right. As to this ordinance, does that, do you think it requires that level of exactitude?
I think the reasonable apportionment case was the WestTrak case out of Grand Junction, which talked about reasonableness and the use of the airport. And so if you took out the constitutional issues, that would be the probably the case to look at. And there it was also off-site providers who are being charged a percentage of their gross revenue.
So I think what you're saying is no, the ordinance doesn't, maybe the Constitution does, but the ordinance doesn't require equal treatment of similarly situated people.
No, I do not think the ordinance language itself would say that, but in our minds, I guess they become merged together because we know we have to comply with those
standards. But the plaintiffs have not raised a constitutional claim. That's why I'm trying to focus on the ordinance.
Right, the reasonable apportionment, if you look at the other cases that the city cited in its brief, including from Virginia, and I believe there was an Alabama case on point, this is the industry standard, and it's the industry standard for a reason. It makes sense, and it's a good measure of the business that is being developed by the off-site providers from the airport. It goes up and down with the business at the airport. In fact, in this case, one of the plaintiffs actually had their costs go down. If it was simply a moneymaker, all of their rates should have gone up significantly. We think that the percentage, using a percentage of gross revenue, when we know 99% or even maybe 100% of their customers are airport customers, is a good measure of their use of the airport.
Ms. Overton, why shouldn't we look at the Thrifty case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why shouldn't we look at the Thrifty case?
I didn't, my time is up, if I can answer.
Please.
We didn't say you couldn't look at the Thrifty case. In fact, we think Thrifty supports us. Thrifty was a motion for summary judgment that had been granted to the city. And the court found that the city had, that there were facts at issue that needed to be looked at by the district court. And while it did say the city had presented evidence of what other airports were using, and the city had presented evidence on a couple of other points, and the court said that wasn't enough on its own. It didn't say, which is what the plaintiffs want you to believe, it didn't say you couldn't look at that. It said it wasn't enough on its own. You had to show reasonable allocation. And so it remanded the case. It didn't make a decision from there. It remanded the case back. The case settled, so there was never a trial. In this case, we did that. We did show allocation. We did show costs. We did show why certain costs were allocated to ground transportation. We did all the things that the Thrifty Court was looking for.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Overton, and thank you again, Mr. Perfermet. Your arguments were well received, and I think they were helpful to the court. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.